Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, May 17th. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us once again to talk about recent events, developments, and technologies in the field of climate change and alternative energy research is Dan DeLurie, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law School. Dan has over 25 years of experience, including as an executive with utilities and clean energy companies. If you have a climate change question or an alternative energy question, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org. But the number again is 800-348-2551. Dan DeLurie and your climate change calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff, here to sort all of this climate change business out and answer your alternative energy questions. Is a favorite of this program, Dan DeLurie, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law School. Dan has over 25 years of experience, including as an exec with utilities and clean energy companies, and has presented at congressional hearings, federal and state agency hearings, White House special events, a UN-accredited delegate to the UN climate change meetings, which are known as COPs. Dan is considered a pioneer in developing content, policy, and programs that combine climate change with new electricity technologies. You got a question? Give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Dan DeLurie, welcome back. How are you?
Well, thanks, Ray. It's always great to be here.
It's beautiful out there, and it's great to have spring in the air once again. You had, you were telling me very briefly, right before we went on, sort of an eye-opening experience over the weekend.
Yeah, it was a bit eye-opening, but certainly a pleasurable experience.
Yeah.
Just 2 days ago on Sunday afternoon, a community group in Bennington invited me to come in and sit with them in discussion, not to give them a presentation, but recognizing that I knew more than the average person about climate change. They just wanted to sit in a circular fashion and talk to me and to each other. And on this program, I know in the past, when talked about what people should do,
yeah,
I've often talked about that being number one or close to the top of the list, and that is talk to each other. It helps you know that other people care about climate change, are concerned about it, and willing to do something about it. You also learn something, and it's your fellow neighbor or citizen that you're talking to and hearing from. I certainly would be willing, to the extent that my calendar allows, to do that for other people that are listening to this program now. So my email address is DeLurieDan, no dot between, at gmail.com.
You better spell DeLurie.
All right. That would be DeLurey, D-A-N at gmail.com. But yeah, I really want to emphasize that it's something that we need to talk about, whether it's at a picnic or a barbecue. The situation is not getting any better, and the time is getting shorter in terms of some of the real bad impacts that lurk in the future.
All right. Now, a couple questions about this event. I don't need to know the specifics of where and who was there and everything else, but you sat in a circle. One, did most people have a little sort of a leery attitude about expressing their beliefs, knowing that there was an expert there?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I mean, people in some cases ask questions, of course, but in many cases, people, they knew a little bit. I mean, anyone who cares about climate or thinks they perhaps should care about climate ought to be, you know, reading about climate as part of their main, you know, information gathering through whether it's newspaper or radio shows or whatever. If you're not seeing any news about climate right now in your normal feed, you probably ought to look for an additional feed to get climate info.
Now, a moment ago, you'd mentioned it's getting pretty late in the game. From a devil's advocate standpoint, what tremendous good can be done from people sitting in a circle in Bennington talking about it?
Well, there's a couple of answers to that question. One is it emboldens people to act knowing that they're not the only one. It also enables them to perhaps act together to do something. The other way I would answer that question is, while you want to try and weigh in somehow on your climate concerns at the federal, state, and local level, the local level, particularly when it comes to municipalities, perhaps has the most tactical ability to affect climate change. 40% of the emissions in the U.S. are from buildings, for example. And building codes are something that normally happens at the local level, or at least they're enforced and monitored at the local level. You've also got a lot of public buildings. And so you, as a climate citizen, let's say, ought to be monitoring your local government to see what they're doing. I think on the last show we talked about zoning and permitting.
Yeah.
That's pretty important. You know, there's, I know some controversies right now in New York State in certain communities about zoning for solar panels and solar farms. And, you know, that's something that needs to be worked out. The one thing people shouldn't be at this point is just a knee-jerk NIMBY, as in not in my backyard. And that's all local level stuff.
Now, we've seen, if you go out south of Albany, you will see, is it north of Albany? Out in Selkirk way, you will see a tremendous solar field. It's over by GE. Is it GE? I don't even remember. Owens Corning. It's a big field. And that seems to be a great spot. It's an industrial zone. But there are those who complain, say, hey, this is arable land here that we are covering up, and there should be farms here. There's that side of that equation as well.
Yeah, again, two things on this one. The first is that it's hard from an economic standpoint, for the project, I mean, to put a solar farm just anywhere.
Yeah.
The farther away it is from a major high voltage line, the harder it makes the economics work for placement of that farm.
Yeah.
But the other thing is there's a lot of, I'd almost call it beyond experimentation, on how you do a solar farm deployment in a way that leaves the land able to be cultivated, but also able to be grazed, particularly by sheep. And so that's not just a one-off. That's been demonstrated that that can really work.
Dan DeLoria is our guest. We talk climate change and alternative energy on this edition of Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. What else has been going on in the news regarding climate change?
Well, I think, you know, it's now pretty clear, and you may have seen some headlines about this, that we are likely to hit this all-important 1.5-degree temperature rise. That's a Celsius figure, at least for a short amount of time over the next few years. And we're probably going to hit it permanently before the end of the decade is out. And it's important to remember, and this is perhaps the real wake-up call here, is that scientists are saying, whether it's the UN scientists or other climate scientists, are saying that in order to maintain that temperature limit or target, we need to reduce emissions by up to 40% over the next 8 years. Emissions are still rising. So, you know, it's hard for me to see how we will actually reduce emissions to that extent.
And once we hit that 1.5 degrees Celsius mark, which you say we will hit temporarily and then it'll go back down and then go back up permanently, once it is permanent, it's game over. We're done?
Well, it's not game over. I mean, it'll go even higher if we don't do something.
We'll be Venus before you know it?
No. I mean, no one listening to us right now is going to die from climate change. I mean, there are, adaptation techniques that will happen. I mean, it's whether it's moving homes in from the edge of the ocean or other things like that. But here in the Northeast, there will be impacts. There'll be hotter temperatures, there'll be more invasive pests, including disease-bearing pests. There'll be a lot more rain. I know we've talked about that in the show before, that the number one impact on Vermont, New York, Massachusetts, and the surrounding area will be an increase in rain, but not constant rain, but what we're seeing almost everywhere now is intense bouts of rain.
The point of my cheeky question about it being game over was from a person who is concerned about these things, if the word is out that 1.5 degrees, this is a key number, and it where you've hit it permanently, what's the impetus then for those listening to you to continue to reduce carbon footprints?
Because we don't want to get any higher than 1.5. 2.0 degrees Celsius increase. And you can look at some of these reports. The UN report we talked about last time, put out by the IPCC. You can Google that and find that report. I mean, that shows the impacts at 1.5, but then it shows the impacts at 2.0. So I think I've used the word continuum before.
Yeah.
We're really on a continuum. We've already put too many emissions into the air. The concentrations of CO2 in the air are the highest they've been in 4 million years. And so we're seeing the effects now. I think probably everyone listening to us, again, has seen some effect of climate change over the past so many years. And so there's a lot of impact baked in. And we just have to remember the all-important lag effect, that we have to do things now to prevent really bad things from happening later.
Dan DeLuria is our guest. It's climate change today on Vox Pop. We'll take a quick break and then get to the calls. 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. It's climate change with Dan DeLuria. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Robert in Saratoga has been waiting a while. Robert, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Like you, very concerned about the future, what it holds for us as you know, humanity. My question is, there's been such a big push for alternative fuel vehicles, solar panels, and whatnot. These tools that we're looking towards are not without any cost or harm. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, lithium ion mining, the lithium batteries themselves, the precious metals that go into making solar panels. Do you know of anything that is up and coming with recycling or reusing lithium ion and, you know, reusing or reconditioning solar panels? Because in the end, I mean, the carbon footprint in just manufacturing and the mining of these materials is massive.
No, you're absolutely right on all of your points. And the increase in electrification and battery use and deployment has actually caught people a little bit by surprise. And by people, I mean the folks who make the batteries and are involved in production of electric vehicles, for example. And so the prices of rare earths and certain minerals that are needed to produce batteries as they're now manufactured has risen. And so that's a problem. Also, recycling of solar panels, I would hazard to say that wasn't planned for either. And so both of these are live balls in the game of clean energy and trying to determine what to do about those. But I would close by saying, remember, it's all about emissions and it's all about the big net calculation when you do these things. So there's no perfect energy source. Everything has something that you wish it didn't have, but anything that reduces emissions overall is what we want.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. I get so many inputs of news all the time. I can't remember where I saw this, but I know I saw it in the last 36 hours or 48 hours. There is a move afoot, or at least the discussion of recycling all of these items that are made with the rare earths, all of these chips and everything else. And so instead of taking it to the one-stop recycler, this will then, they will repurpose all of these chips or the parts of these chips, and it'll be an expensive proposition, but there'll be less mining if it's all done that way.
Yeah, I can't really go deep on that with you, Ray. I know about as much as you've just said in terms of that issue. I know that there's a lot of talk about the economics driving that. As I just mentioned, the prices are skyrocketing. And so anytime a price skyrockets for something, then there's more incentive to recycle it. But I think from a technology standpoint, there's still some work to be done there.
Also, with regard to recycling solar panels, we had a discussion on the Science Forum about this the last time the scientists were here. You know, they're wedged together with this epoxy, and it's so tough to get them apart that might be able to do it, but it'll be cost prohibitive.
Yeah, the other thing on storage, and I think we've talked about this before, is the future of storage is not all batteries. There are other ways to store energy.
Give me an example.
An example is like a chemical cell or fuel cell, where it uses a chemical process to create and store potential energy, if you remember from your high school physics.
Sure, vaguely, yes. It was a long time ago, but yes.
And so that's what you want to do. You want to store energy somehow. I mean, even a flywheel is a way to physically store energy, and or pumping water uphill and then letting it flow down through a generator is a way to store energy.
Dan DeLoria is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Sarah writes, what can I do in my day-to-day life to limit my carbon footprint? Is it possible to leave no carbon footprint? What can I do? And that's from Sarah.
Sarah, I am so glad you asked that question. Most list of things to do about climate change is headed up by reduce your carbon footprint. And that implies that we all should take this on as a personal responsibility. That is reducing emissions. That's what the carbon footprint means. And that's true. We should all take this on as responsibility. But we shouldn't beat ourselves up over that, because the fact is, even if all of us make significant reductions in our carbon footprint, it won't be enough. Not when you have 100 companies worldwide responsible for the majority of emissions worldwide. It's actually been demonstrated and proven. There's evidence to show that a few of the oil and gas companies actually are the ones that created the concept of a carbon footprint. In other words, personal responsibility. It's the consumer's job to reduce these emissions.
So when's the corporate responsibility going to take effect?
Well, corporate responsibility can take place in a number of different ways, but the best way is when the government does something. Because we're talking about, when it's climate change and emissions, we're talking about what's called a public externality. It's pollution.
Yeah.
And the problem with pollution is if corporations don't have to pay for it, if it's not a cost factor for the corporations, then it's that less likely that they'll do something about it. So I think climate change is the biggest challenge for government that we've ever had. And unfortunately, government isn't responding.
Okay, let's say our government responds, and I know President Biden has plans, and many presidents have had plans. Let's just say all those plans come to fruition here. What do you do about the governments that aren't so amenable to the idea?
First, the good news is many governments are, and governments
the
in
big
West-
ones aren't.
No, I'll get to that.
Right.
And Western Europe governments and others. I think on one show I mentioned that carbon tax is happening in a lot of places elsewhere in the world, but not here in the U.S. So a lot of the world looks at us as a laggard. So remember, you got to stand in each other's shoes to see what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take China, for example. I mean, China has done some good things, but they're also continuing to build coal plants and increase their emissions. So one of the things with China and with other countries that is being talked a lot about in Washington is a border adjustment clause, to where you would impose a fee or a tariff on products coming in from a country that wasn't doing, let's say, its best to reduce emissions. And so therefore, you have some leverage over trying to get them to do the right thing. But otherwise, remember, if we all fall on our sword when it comes to climate change, that won't be good either.
No, but if we fall on the sword, we won't know it, you know? But, you know, getting back to China for a minute, and the idea of putting this, what do you call it, a border...
Border adjustment tariff,
we'll say.
Yeah.
It always comes down to the consumer paying the ultimate price there, though, right? Because the prices will just go up.
Well, it could. I mean, that's basic economics and marketing and production and business, so it could.
Well, consumer economy can only stand so much of that before nobody can afford to buy anything.
Well, but again, if emissions, if carbon pollution is priced into the system by way of a carbon tax or fee or something like that, then the products and services with less carbon are going to be the cheaper and therefore the more preferred. I mean, I think, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Well, I think ultimately it comes down to people buying less stuff. I think that might be the change. You know?
I don't want to talk about anything that dilutes anyone's effort on their own carbon footprint.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things we can do. In fact, let me mention two things. One is something that a caller mentioned on a previous show, and that is Project Drawdown. There's a book, but also a website. And
we talked about that.
That's the best shopping list out there for actions. Not all of them are individual actions, but there are some there. And you can go to the website. You don't have to buy the book. The other is something that recently happened. A friend of mine named Heather White developed a website and has put out a book called One Green Thing. And basically, it on the website, you can take a personality test to see what kind of a climate activist or warrior or champion you should be. And there's like 8 different categories. And I took it myself, and I ended up categorized as a beacon because I like to advocate. But it's a great site. It's just a quick personality test, and it will also give you tips based on the type of person that you are as to how you should do something for the climate.
Dan DeLore joins us today. We'll get back to the phones right now. 800-348-2551. We go way up north, and Chris in Altona. Chris, you're on.
Well, thanks for taking the call, and good afternoon.
Hi.
My question is about the infrastructure, the electrical infrastructure, and up in Clinton County, Franklin County, we have a number of windmills. We have several hundred windmills. We have solar farms. We have individual households that contribute. And down the road, with more and more people, like our county bus system, the new buses purchased aren't diesel. They're hybrid, you know, or maybe they're all electric. I'm not sure, and I should be, but I apologize for that. And with the new purchases for school districts of buses, I'm sure the subject's coming up. In fact, I want to raise it with my school board about purchasing such vehicles and getting the power from the resources, or be it from the hydroelectric power from Niagara or the nuclear that's contributed also. Can the current electrical grid handle that? And if not, what's to be done? And that's my question. I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
Chris, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Let's start with just a quick overview of the electricity system. Historically, it's been described as having three major parts. generation, which are the power plants, transmission, which are the high voltage lines that you see in a few places, and then distribution. And those are the wires that take the electricity from those high voltage wires and step it down, run it through substations, and eventually it ends up on the wires on your street and from there into your home. And so in terms of the way the system is evolving, since there's a desire, or I would say a need, for renewable energy, you want to go to where the renewable energy is and try and get that to where the need for power is. And so that's why you're having some of the development attempts here in the Northeast to try and utilize hydro, for example.
Are you in favor of Hydro-Québec?
You mean in terms of a specific proposal?
The line going through Maine down, it's been in the news quite a bit in Maine and the subject of litigation.
No, I'm not familiar enough to comment. I mean, I can comment in general, as I often do, and say that, you know, something has to go somewhere in terms of getting zero emission energy into the system.
Yeah.
And I guess I would leave it at that because I'm not familiar enough with it. But the other thing that's happening is, with solar, whether it's a community solar project, a solar farm, whether it's the local wind turbines on a ridge or whatever, you know, they are now local generation. It's not like the old days where a power plant that creates your electricity is hundreds or 1,000 miles away. And so one of the challenges of the electricity system, particularly here in the East, is the distribution system may not be designed to handle all of the local distributed generation and distribution of that electricity. And so that is a challenge. That's why you have utilities focused very much on that distribution system now and making sure that it's strong and robust enough to handle that. As well as, you know, the other side of the coin for utilities and their infrastructure is making sure that it's resilient. Because the increased extreme weather and other factors, they've got to take care of that as well.
You know, I saw a thing in the news, and this was fairly prominent, I don't know, maybe last month. The Biden administration is earmarking $6 billion to rescue, quote-unquote, nuclear power plants that are in danger of closing. What's your general opinion on that effort?
Well, at the risk of repeating one of my favorite little lines that I think I did on an earlier show, when I was young and in college, I protested against nuclear power plants because it seemed to me like a pretty stupid way to boil water to make electricity. Now I'm in a very different place on nuclear because it's all about emissions. And I would rather trust technology to take care of the nuclear waste problem than I would technology to take care of trillions of different points where carbon dioxide is emitted.
If this effort, I know that you are at Vermont Law School, if this effort by the Biden administration had taken place several years ago, would you have wanted them to save Vermont Yankee from decommissioning?
Well, that's a specific question about a specific plant, so I'm hesitant to answer that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know the numbers. I know Vermont Yankee was a very old plant, and it's not the only plant that's been decommissioned around the U.S. because of its age. But I think what you're seeing recently, some states have passed, and Illinois is the most recent example of where they passed a big energy law where they created I don't think they call it a subsidy, but it's financial assistance to a nuclear plant based on its electricity being emissions-free.
Mm. All right. Dan DeLoria is our guest. We'll take a break here. And as we go to that break, Dan, we had an email from Ethan. It says, can you repeat the address where the climate quiz is? Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah. If you go to the website called onegreenthing.org, and the woman's name is Heather White. One green thing, there may be some other, you know, uses of that phrase on the internet, but onegreenthing.org by Heather White.
All right, we'll be right back with Dan DeLoria and your calls.
Oh,
Vox Pop on WAMC. It is climate change today with our buddy Dan DeLore from Vermont Law School. Number is 800-348-2551. And Mike is in New Windsor. Mike, you're on.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
I have a more selfish topic to talk about. I'm putting an addition on my son's house this summer, and they have gas and electric already established at their place. Our builder is suggesting that we go rather with a heat pump and some other maybe roof tiles or whatever those things, solar panels. So I was wondering if you could give me a suggestion, what would be the best choice?
If you're talking about the best choice in terms of brand product, I can't really do that.
Yeah, but that's not a good idea.
Yeah, but if you're talking about whether or not to go with the heat pump, I would say all other things equal, yes. It's now been proven that there's a myth of heat pumps not working in cold northeastern temperatures. In fact, they work a lot farther north than where we are.
Is it a myth or is it just improving technology?
I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you. Okay. I mean, once upon a time, yes, the heat pumps did not work in cold climates, but that's not the case anymore. And so the combination of a heat pump and solar panels, that's a pretty good combination. And again, I can't advise you on the economics. I don't know the size of your house. I can't do anything like that. But I think that you're definitely, on the right track. Is that answer your question, or was I off base on that?
That pretty much answers the question. We just wanted to know what the best technology was, really.
Yeah, maybe the other thing I'll throw in here is my usual shout out to electrification. Natural gas is fossil gas. It has emissions. And so while it may be the case that it has less emissions than oil and coal, we're now realizing that it has a lot of methane emissions back where it's produced in the fields. And so natural gas is definitely not an emissions-free fuel. And when you use an electric vehicle or a heat pump or anything like that, as the grid gets more emissions-free renewables on it, your heat pump and your vehicle is going to get cleaner and cleaner just by sitting there.
Mike, thank you very much for the call. Dan DeLore joins us today. It's climate change on Vox Pop. And Fred is in Wineskill. Fred, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the methane. I don't know if it's a tipping point or anything like that, but I was watching some interesting programs that talked about basically, over the Ice Age, which is about 2 million years, there was the incorporation of plant and animal material into the ground. It's frozen in there. So it's been stored in there in the permafrost for 2 million years. There's a lot of it in there. They were showing how in lakes that were frozen over, they'd knock a hole in the ice, and they'd have a torch, and they'd have like a 20-foot torch of methane coming up in the air. And they were talking about, if the temperature got high enough, that enough of this methane could be released, which holds the heat way more than carbon dioxide. And they were talking about if that happens, that's a real, real big problem. And so it's really important that we keep those temperatures down so that doesn't happen. The second thing is that they didn't mention is once that methane is in the air, it oxidizes into carbon dioxide. So it's like a double whammy. The other thing is, I think at the root of this whole thing is it's a biological problem. There's too many people on this planet. And I would just suggest to people, hey, if you want to have a kid, fine. Anymore, adopt them. There's so many kids on this planet already that need homes, but I don't know if you're ever going to get that bit in the mouth of mankind. I like the show. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
All right, Fred.
Thank you.
Dan, you want to comment?
I would just give you a thumbs up on your characterization of the methane issue, including the permafrost. That's talked about as a tipping point in that, and this goes back to, Ray, our discussion about the 1.5 versus the 2 and so on, is that if we don't take steps— it just is going to get worse and worse because it's going to be, you know, something else that a little bit more temperature rise causes that to happen, a little bit more causes this to happen, and so on.
Knowing what you know, how do you sleep at night?
What's that phrase about? Like a baby and I wake up every hour and cry? No, I'm kidding. No, I mean, look, it is what it is. And so, you know, I try and spend my days doing what I can to help people be aware of it, to understand it. And that's my way of trying to do what I can. I mean, I'm not an engineer, so I can't go out and, you know, build a power plant. And so this is what I do. And again, this is where I think to get back to what should people do. We're all different. And the things that we do with respect to helping on climate change are probably different. But we all have to do something at this point.
This email from Maureen, and then we'll go back to the phones. Nuclear as clean energy. I have been enjoying this conversation, but I must disagree with Dan's view on nuclear power. Just like we should not invest further in coal or gas, we should not be throwing money to the nuclear industry, and Biden is wrong to support this. That's from Maureen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't personally care about nuclear or many other things. I'm just about emissions. And if something is going to give me electricity without producing emissions by doing it, whether it's a wind turbine, a solar panel, or a nuclear plant. Now, it's not fair to equate those three mm-hmm. in that sentence because nuclear, as I said in the beginning, it's kind of a crazy way to make electricity, but it is a way to make a lot of electricity at once you develop it. So, and we have to remember that nuclear is quite prevalent elsewhere in the world. In France, the majority of their electricity comes from nuclear energy.
Yep. Dan DeLore is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. We go to Poughkeepsie. Joseph, you're on. Joseph, are you still with us? You've been on hold 30 minutes. Joseph's taking a nap.
Sorry, Joseph.
Joseph, if you call back, we'll put you on.
Joseph,
still there.
Joseph,
go ahead. You're on.
Yes, I'm still here.
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, I love the topic. I think in America, when we talk about the increase in temperature, we should use Fahrenheit because Celsius tend to confuse most people. But if we would say 2.7 degrees, most people, oh, that's a lot. And Sarah asked a very important question, what can I do? And I love your host response. Not very much we can do personally. When we have big companies, violating regulations. You know, I learned in one planning law school that energy companies are exempt from environmental pollution. That's a problem. And what we need to do, actually, Americans, we need to reduce our consumption. We consume exponentially higher than just about any society in the world. If we keep doing this, we'll continue to hurt ourselves and the rest of the world. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Joseph, thanks. Dan, what do you say?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I want to go back to, I don't think I said exactly how you quoted me, Joseph, in terms of there's not very much we can do, because there's a lot we can do. I mean, there's a list of probably 20 good things that any of us can do to reduce our carbon footprint. What I said, I think, or what I certainly meant to say is that don't beat yourself up by thinking that, you know, by doing your carbon footprint or by maybe changing this much instead of that much, that's going to make that big of a difference. Because I'm looking at the big scheme of things and encourage you all to do that now. So we should be reducing our carbon footprint, but also looking to government and to corporations, and importantly, looking to government to force corporations to reduce their emissions.
Don writes in, I drive all day past fields of solar panels. This is ugly. No trees, no farms, no nature, just miles of ugly metal. How can we save the planet without making it look like crap? And that's from Don.
Well, I'm not sure, Don, because as I said, something has to go somewhere to get us out of this. And so some people I know look at a field of solar panels and think that that's high technology coming to the rescue on climate change. And other people certainly look at them and say, God, I wish that was still a field. I really like seeing it that way. So I'm not sure I have any answer other than that, but we have to do something. We can't just look away and expect that the problem's going to be taken care of
by itself.
You know, there's
another aspect to this, and it's you get the local governments. In my town, I see solar, but what I see is all the fields becoming parcels of land for houses. At some point, I think that there has to be maybe some consideration about that.
Well, you've just opened up a good one on that, Ray. As I mentioned before, one of the powers of local government is zoning and permitting. And it's been proven that dispersed housing is not as energy efficient as congregated housing, such as in cities and towns and so on. So, you know, and it gets into all sorts of other issues in terms of drainage and how, what that does in terms of water flow and extreme weather and things like that. And so, you know, everything should have climate as a consideration now, everything that local government does. Now, here's, and a lot of people may have seen this because it was front page news, but a few days ago, a house in the Outer Banks, which is that resort area on a sandbar in North Carolina. So a house that a fellow purchased 9 months ago just slipped into the sea because of a storm surge due to a storm.
Yeah.
And so, again, the issues of housing and real estate and homeowner insurance and all of that, I mean, we could spend the whole show on that.
Yeah, maybe we'll do that. You're going to be on again very soon. Let's go to Shelby in Goshen, Massachusetts. Shelby, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You guys did it's a good segue there because housing is sort of my viewpoint on the whole climate change thing, because I've been working with building what's called carbon sequestering housing. They're houses that the material choices and the construction methods that are chosen are actually chosen because they have a negative carbon footprint. They actually hold more carbon than has been emitted in their processing or in their construction. We do a lot of work that is based off of a group called the Endeavor Center, which if people are interested in this kind of a topic, they can go look up. And basically the idea is that all the high-performance housing people have been building over the past 2 years has so much more carbon emissions in the construction that there's actually no environmental benefit for about 30-plus years compared to a standard, you know, run-of-the-mill development home. And because the big thing that we're sort of looking at is, you know, we don't have 30 to 40 years to solve this problem. We have 3 to 5, you know, to start bringing our carbon down. And, you know, a single home can reduce, you know, have a carbon sequestering footprint of, you know, many tons of carbon. So in, you know, the larger term, it can really make a big difference.
Yeah. I mean,
it's something that I don't think people talk about enough is,
no,
you know,
it hasn't,
choice and stuff like that.
No, it has not been talked about enough. Embedded carbon in building materials has been a sleeper issue, and it's only now getting some accelerated attention, whether it be from building codes in some of the more progressive cities across the country, or whether it be with a focus on industries. The production of concrete worldwide is one of the biggest emitting activities that there is.
Hmm.
You're also seeing a resurgence of wood being used, even for, you know, high-rise buildings. So definitely, you know, just the use of all this concrete, and there's now low emissions concrete because they're producing it in a different way. So thank you, Shelby. That's an important area.
The question I have for you, and maybe you don't have an answer for this, and I know it annoys you when I do
this. Of course I do. Of course
I do.
I
do this to you every show. You have these models, and you say the 1.5 Celsius, or 2.7, I think, as one of our callers mentioned, Fahrenheit, you have that occurring in X number of years. Has anybody modeled out how many years it would be if unabated the rise in global temperatures continue before the planet is uninhabitable.
Can you say that again? How many years?
How many years, according to... Is there a model? You say 1.5 degrees Celsius soon, and that is sort of a point of no return. Is there a model that says, okay, if this continues, we won't be able to live here anymore?
Actually, yes, but not exactly. Okay, the IPCC and other organizations and institutions do modeling. They do scenarios, like one with 100% abatement and one with no abatement.
Yeah.
Abatement meaning, you know, what you're going to do to reduce emissions. And so there are such scenarios. But it's important to understand, and I want to go back to the 1.5 versus the 2.7, because our caller was correct.
In Fahrenheit.
In Fahrenheit. And you know, the reason I use the 1.5 is that's what you're going to see in the newspaper. In terms of a report on something that came out, because remember, the world is in the metric system, and so that's the way these worldwide reports come out. But here in the Northeast, we've actually already gone above 2 degrees on average, and that leads me to go back to your question, that different parts of the world are still going to have different temperatures. So I think the threshold for constant exposure to temperature after which you die is something like 124 Fahrenheit or one something like that. And so some places are going to reach that quite quickly, actually, but other places won't. So it's kind of I don't want to be silly about this, but not everybody's going to die at once, and not everybody's going to, you know, have the same impacts. And that's kind of a flip way to say it, but I want to emphasize that, you know, things are not going to happen uniformly around the world.
All right. I had a great question here from Cheryl, and now we don't have enough time to ask this one. So, Cheryl, if you could write us again the next time Dan DeLore is here, I promise we will do this one first. Great conceptual question. I'm going to leave you hanging on this, Dan DeLore. We're done.
Oh, I don't even get the question?
No.
Oh, you're good.
Even going to tell you Cheryl's question.
Okay.
Next time you're here, and we already have it scheduled, we'll do that one.
Yeah, the only thing I want to say in closing, Ray, is I think in this show, maybe I got a little bit more, you know, frank about some of what we're facing.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, the information feedback loop is causing me to be that way. So, you know, I'm not trying to scare anyone. I'm just trying to make sure they know that we're in a real crisis here.
I'll still invite you back. Dan DeLore, thanks a lot.
Thanks,
support
Ray.
Comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years. QFCC.com. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts, family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation, services, and deliveries. GeorgePropane.com. Herzog Law Firm, working to protect their clients' assets, focusing on Medicaid and estate planning, serving the Capital Region, Hudson Valley, and Adirondacks, 518-465-7581. At Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarriers and fabricators used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. Thanks again to Dan DeLore and to you and to Zach and to Ed Rosen. God bless us, everyone. Tomorrow, it's Pets and Vets. We'll see you, too.